Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter Llewellyn. I run services at medcomsnetworking.com. So information services, resources, activities for people who work in and around medical communications, medical education, medical publishing, and associated businesses across the world, basically. And also for people who want to join the business. Maybe you're a medical, you want to be a medical writer or account manager or whatever. So you'll find lots of information at firstmedcomsjob.com, which will hopefully help you understand the business and guide you in. Everybody should find lots of information that they're interested in at Network Pharma TV. There's more than 500 videos now on all sorts of topics. So lots to go and have a look at. We're talking to you on the 14th of June, 2023. So let's make a point of the fact that it's Medcoms Day, hashtag Medcoms Day. So there's all sorts of things going on out there, and we're demonstrating there's an amazing global community of people out there. And hopefully, whatever time you watch this video, if you go to hashtag Medcoms, you'll find some discussion and some commentary going on. But today, once a year, this is our 12th year, and it goes a little bit bonkers, and it is going a bit bonkers out there. And today, what we're doing today, we've got three industry leaders. Can I call you industry leaders? Joining me today to talk about the sort of state of Medcoms, future directions. It's just a discussion. We're going to be winging it a little bit. We're quite happy to admit that. We have a big international audience here today. So hopefully they'll feed in their questions and commentary. And we're just going to talk between ourselves and maybe argue a little bit between ourselves about where Medcoms is at the moment and where it's going. Who's going to start? Annette, we said you'd kick us off. So tell us who you are, Annette, a little bit of the personal journey, but basically who are you and where are you? And we'll go around each of the panelists, starting with Annette.
Okay, thanks so much, Peter, and happy Medcoms Day to everybody. It's great to have the opportunity to kind of celebrate all the great work that we all do in Medcoms. And for those of you who aren't in Medcoms yet, maybe, then, you know, maybe we'll give you a bit of a taste of you know, what kind of things we get up to. So I've been in Medcoms for coming up to 19 years now, starting as a medical writer after my PhD. Worked in independent med ed agencies. I've done a bit of work in CROs, so writing kind of regulatory documents, but most of my work really firmly in the kind of Medcoms space. I currently work at Langland. We're part of the Publicis Group, which most people perhaps will have heard of. It's a large group of agencies around the world, not just in healthcare, but all other things. Langland itself is, we're sort of set up as a multidisciplinary team, so all within a single agency. So we've got clinical trials experience, PR and policy, advertising, and then medical strategy and education. So each of those kind of teams has its own projects, its own accounts, just like any kind of other independent sort of team, and we as MSE do our medical strategy and education. We do similar work to other independent med ed kind of agencies. We'd like to push the strategy a bit more than some places, I think, but kind of, I guess, aligned with what other people in independent agencies might know. But also we get to pull in kind of other perspectives from the other teams, which is, I think, becoming increasingly valuable for us and our clients, and doing some kind of cross-discipline work as well. So I'm responsible for our medical writers, most of whom, well, they all sit within our MSE team. We have also writers in, medical copywriters in all the other teams as well. And I'm really keen to kind of bring them together as well, because I think there's a really good opportunity to kind of learn from each other. And, you know, because I think Medcoms for me is very much on the spectrum, and there's not really a black and white line between where, you know, a medical education kind of stops and advertising starts, for example. So I'm very keen to kind of boost our kind of skills. Certainly I'm very passionate from a very sort of writing scientific perspective. That's where my real passions lie. And I do as much as I can to kind of try and evolve how we work and do the best work that we can.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks, Annette. We said we'd go around in alphabetical order. So Gary, you're next. Who are you and where are you?
Thanks, Peter. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody who's joined in today on this Medcoms Day. It's great to speak with you all. So, yes, I'm Gary Lyons. I'm head of commercial at Fisherwack Medical, part of Fisherwack Health. I'm also head of our strategy team as well. We're a group of about 1,500 people across various offices across, obviously, UK, US, and Far East location as well. And really, we have a number of disciplines within our business. We call ourselves a purposely built commercialization partner. And what I mean by that is that we have medical affairs, medical communications expertise, of course, but we also have marketing, policy, value, evidence, access and consulting. So a bit like you were saying, Annette, we like to bring our strengths together. And I think that's, you know, we've seen that because the external environments is really asking for that. You know, the complex challenges that are out there really need a different approach at times. So delighted to speak to you from this base in terms of my journey. I have a pharma background, so I've always been interested in innovation and transformation of medicine and healthcare. So started my journey in pharma in marketing, oddly enough. And then I came over to medical communications just over 20 years ago. And I've always been interested in innovation. More recently, I've spoken at industry events such as ISMAP, for example, on the future of medical affairs, and also on omnichannel engagements, which is also another current topic as well. I'm sure we'll probably get onto at some point. So, yeah, very passionate about the future of medical communications, where it's going, and look forward to talking about it today.
Excellent. Thanks, Gary. So, Jane, come on then, same question to you. Where are you? Who are you?
Thanks, Peter. So I'm Jane, and I'm a director with Amiculum. I started my career in medical communications with a degree in chemistry, realised pretty quickly that for the safety of everyone around me, I should never be allowed to work in a lab. So I took a different direction and went into science communication. So initially, as a science journalist and in publishing, and then I took my first MedComms job about 25 years ago. So I've been working in the industry all that time, starting off as an editor and then moving into commercial roles. The last 11 years have been with Amiculum. So just to tell you a little bit about Amiculum, we're an independent healthcare communications company comprising a number of different specialist agencies across the world. So there's 350 team members worldwide. We've got teams in the US, UK, Middle East, Switzerland, Asia, and New Zealand as well. And we have both specialist and generalist healthcare communications companies that deliver the full range of services to clients across the world. My role as a director is to oversee our UK and US operations. So I work with all of the teams based in the UK and the US.
Excellent. Okay, thanks. It's worth acknowledging that the three of you represent three of the larger communication groups, basically, in MedComms. MedComms is quite a broad church. Let's just sort of get some context here. You know, there's lots of small agencies and individuals working in MedComms. There's larger independent groups. There's big networked agencies and so on. For the purposes of today, I was quite keen that we got three of you who have quite a broad perspective across MedComms, but we're gonna have a bit of a freewheeling discussion here. But perhaps we can start with just partly acknowledging the fact that when we talk about MedComms, we're probably all talking about slightly different definitions, and actually, it's getting more complicated these days, isn't it? I'm always a little nervous when someone says, "What does MedComms mean?" But it's becoming more complicated, and you've all touched on it. There's a lot more strategy in there. There's omnichannel and so on. Just maybe, and we need to be a bit careful with some of this, but you know, can I bounce around each of you? I mean, by definition, we've all been around a little while and we've seen the evolution of the business, and particularly in the last couple of years, I think we'd all agree things have changed and moved on a lot. So I'm going to bounce around. I'm going to start with Gary. Just give us a sense of what's happened over the last couple of years. Where are we today? How different is MedComms now than it was, I don't know, 5 years ago?
That's a good question. I think it mirrors the developments of the healthcare industry in many respects. You know, we've gone, as we know, from, you know, treatments that treat, you know, broad sections of populations to much more personalized medicine. And really that along with the, I guess, technology development that we've seen in the digital space, you know, giving patients access to much more information than before and generating much more data, means that really there's a much more sophisticated and complex landscape out there, really, and the expectation of personalization. So I think that is really showing, we're all consumers of data, and obviously HCPs are as well, and they look for more personalized approaches. So we're seeing that, aren't we? We're seeing omnichannel being the reflection of that need for personalization to give the format in the way it's needed, more concise. And we're seeing, you know, an explosion of data. It's like a tsunami of healthcare data, and it's how to really navigate through that. I think is really key to really getting the right insight, which then is, you know, going to generate the right kind of content. So I think we're seeing a lot of complexity in trying to get through that data, the different types of technologies, the platforms, and the types of staff that you need really to be able to generate insight. And then coupled with the technology and bringing that and understanding where it's all going, really, in terms of, you know, those different segments. You know, we talk about archetypes and personas and things like this, which are much more marketing oriented terms, but now coming much more into the medical affairs space. I think we're seeing, you know, closer working between medical and marketing within pharma, not completely, of course, but definitely an integration around some activities, around things like customer journeys and things like that, which are really increasing the sophistication of the solution we need to offer in medical communication. So I think so. Those are some of the flavors I'm seeing. There's others as well, but I'll certainly pass to the others to comment further.
Okay, go on, Jane, pick that up. And also, it's very medical affairs orientated now, isn't it? It's not, you know, whereas in the good old days when I started out, it was very much the commercial side that was driving Medcom. So again, Jane, just pick that up and talk a little bit from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but I think the constant in medcoms is change, because our clients are constantly changing and adapting. We're seeing new breakthroughs in science, new use of technology, etc. And there's an industry we need to keep up with that. We need to, you know, adapt and deliver new services or different ways of delivering the same services to meet our clients' needs. So it's an exciting time, but there's always this sense of change within medcoms. We are seeing some clients who are post-pandemic kind of just taking stock and restructuring, looking at how they're delivering services. And then we've got other areas of the business that are booming. So it's a whole roller coaster, which is, I'm sure, what Gary and Annette experience as well.
Okay. Annette, again, your comment, and particularly after the last couple of years, it's gone very digital. I mean, I know we all like to stay in medcoms, but we're going in this direction anyway, you know, with digitization. So, but I don't know whether anyone would say we haven't been kicked very hard and very fast down this line over the last couple of years. So the business as a whole has moved very quickly. Would you agree with that, Annette?
Yeah, I think we're definitely being asked more and more for digital kind of solutions, and it's the way that we, you know, needs go as a company. And, you know, we know that it's not going to be just reliant on rep visits and MSL visits anymore, and there's going to be a lot more things that are done, I guess, remotely. And, you know, where maybe there's not a member of pharma staff with that customer, so I think that gives us an extra challenge. You know, how do we make sure that all the communications that we are developing, you know, are going to really engage? I mean it's a case whether or not you've got a rep there or not, or on MSL, but I think even more so if you've really got to hold someone's attention, you've got to really want them to come and engage with your materials. I think it just gives us a much bigger challenge for how do we do that. And I think the digitization, it gives you so many opportunities, and it gives you so many opportunities, I think, for metrics. I think it's one other thing, you know, is your education working? Like, are you able to gather data that kind of actually shows you what is helping you to communicate that information? I think that's a really interesting kind of way which we need to kind of move forward in. I'm not sure that it's certainly nowhere near kind of optimized, and, you know, whether the platforms are available, whether people are then going to go to the platforms, how do you make things that are engaging and can get people to interact with them so that you can both make the education better but also gather information on it, but not make them just gimmicky or, you know, put interactivity in for, you know, no purpose, no real purpose apart from to make it look flashy. So I think the digital piece just brings a whole host of different questions, but, you know, they're interesting challenges for us all, I think.
I think you're touching on an interesting aspect there, the question of sort of measuring the effectiveness of what we do. You know, yonks ago when I started, I mean, if you had ran an event, I mean, essentially it was how many seats have been filled, and that was it. You know, if you had and you made the room look full, and you know, everyone was happy, sort of thing. I know we're in a very different era now, and I know everyone talks a lot about it, but in reality, and you're saying, Annette, that we think we've got further to go. What do you reckon, Gary? I mean, I would argue that we're still not great at measuring what we do, but I'm not sure sometimes, whether it's because we're not great at it or whether the clients who might well be asking the questions, but they don't want to know the answers anyway, sort of thing. Because there's a very human nature, which is that, you know, how many people came to my webinar? And if it isn't lots and lots of people, then we don't want to know about it. And therefore, we don't survive, et cetera. So there's a whole minefield in here. But what's your take on how much the industry wants to know what we're doing is working and how much we're actually able to deliver the answers?
I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a clamour for data. You know, we clearly see that in all different directions. Analytics, as Annette mentions, you know, is a constant conversation, isn't it? But analytics only tell certain part of the story. You know, they might give you a level of engagement, numbers of people visiting websites and these kind of things. But do they really tell you, you know, whether clinical practice is changing, whether new medicines are being adopted? Obviously, we don't get into prescriptions and things like that, which is the ultimate hard metric the marketing teams use and the sales teams. But so it's therefore much harder to have surrogate markers of behavior change and shift. And, you know, I'm sure different agencies have different approaches to how they get into that, for example. But I was at the MAPS meeting just a few months ago in Nashville, and there's a session talking about, you know, the future of medical affairs. And really, you know, how can we measure the impact of medical affairs? And to be honest with you, there's no really consensus on it. You know, there's certain things about, oh, it's good to measure scientific share of voice. It's good to measure sentiment, change in sentiment, things like this. And there's different social media tools to do that, for example, and other ways as well. But I think they kind of landed on the end position, which was, you know, it was almost a statement of, I guess a fact in terms of medical affairs adds value, and a lot of medical affairs leaders from pharma didn't seem too bothered. You know, they weren't too concerned that they were able to ultimately measure that impact, knowing, to your point, Peter, that it is quite hard to get to that end stage. So I think we see a lot of different opinions on it, you know, and I think, to your point, I don't think we've got to that point where we know really how to measure effectiveness. I think we've all got different approaches. There's some good approaches, don't get me wrong, there's some good data, but to measure behavior shift, it's not easy, really.
I think and okay, I'm oversimplifying things here, but in the digital world, everyone thinks you can measure everything, expect some numbers, but you know, the number of hits on a publication, you know, on a website being quoted as some sort of success criteria is just a joke, isn't it? And yet it's still being done. And it's like, it's very, very difficult, to your point. I mean, it's what you want to know is if someone is actually, not some electronic bot has actually hit the paper in the first place. So is it a real person? And if it's a real person, have they downloaded a paper? Have they read the paper? They've done something about it. I think we gloss over it far too much, in my opinion. But Jane, go on. Have you got an opinion on that sort of issue?
I agree with Gary. It's there's a lot more that we can do, and there's certainly in its infancy. Clients are along a spectrum, I guess, of how they're adopting this or rolling it out. I would say that we've had to get better at metrics and analyzing data, and certainly as medicine has moved towards a more personalized approach, you can't simply count attendee numbers, etc. Particularly if, you know, for our teams who are working in rare diseases, cell and gene therapies, you're talking about quite small populations, so, you know, overall number of attendees just doesn't work anymore. I don't think any client has got it right yet, but it's certainly an area that we need to invest more time in.
Some of these questions I'm not going to quite sure where it's going to lead. Do you get any of your clients demanding outcome metrics in order to effectively measure your performance? How does that sort of dynamic
more,
work?
More if we're suggesting them, to be honest. It feels like it's more the okay. Other way around, like from my perspective anyway, that, you know, we're often pushing for real clear objectives for a piece of work that then, of course, which of course you need in order to have the metrics to be able to measure.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you're often the ones that are pushing that. Don't know about
Gary, you're agreeing with that, are you?
I do. Yeah, I think, you know, you can measure things like reach, you know, like you said, you know, different metrics linked to digital activities. You can, you know, like I was saying before, you can split into segments and personas, and you can even measure some of those things more specifically, so you can get a section of the audience in terms of being better characterized. But I think it's still difficult to, you know, once you get into actual impact, you're trying to, as I say, you're trying to measure behavior change. There's different, qualitative measures you can use, things like net promoter score, how much would you advocate this activity to others? That's used quite a lot now, isn't it? So, it's a validated approach. And there's different ways in which you can use that. And I think, those kind of questions are probably, in many respects, the nearest we get. You can benchmark opinion at certain time points, but that's quite hard to track, really, and it's expensive to track as well. So I think it is difficult, above and beyond, a question post-activity of how much has this activity, changed your approach to, your thoughts around the disease state or, adoption of certain data. Is it going to make you think about changing things? It's kind of harder to get, much more in depth than that, really, I think. I think most farmers are quite happy with that type of questioning at the moment because we don't have that, that magic bullet that we're talking about here.
I think it's interesting seeing some of the comments coming in. I mean, we're talking about there being a mixed sort of views on metrics and so on. But I think one of the comments is essentially saying what I think is probably right, which is that very often it's very expensive to do the measurements. And it's easy to chop that bit of the equation. Let's concentrate on getting something done. And then we'll think about whether it's worked or not, rather than putting in place some expensive resource that's determining whether it works. I mean, again, being a bit cynical, I can see that happening quite a lot in practice, to be honest. Yeah,
that's a fair comment.
We need to think about like how sophisticated we want to get with metrics as well. And I think it's a conversation to be had because you could, go down the expensive route of trying to kind of get something really robust, and or you could do more of a kind of quick, some kind of quick assessment that you could do across everything. You know it's dirty, not going to tell you everything, but if you gather enough data, then it might tell you something. Do you know what I mean? So I think we have to figure out like what's worth spending our efforts on as well. I don't think we have any conclusions there yet, but it probably depends on the situation, to be honest.
I think the worst thing is to spend a lot of time and effort on measuring something and then provide a bunch of data, give it to somebody, and then you just see them sort of put it over there.
Go with what they thought already.
Exactly. I think we've all been in those positions. Sorry, I cut across you there, Gary. Sorry.
No, it's fine. There's so many different data sources as well. That's a challenge, as to which is the best data source to go to for a definitive picture of an activity's impact. You can survey a bunch of HCPs through tools like Thermo. To the comment made that these are expensive tools to use, and there's lots of other ways you can do it as well. But I don't think there's not a lot of unification of which metrics, which data points to define what is impact. Even trying to measure it, you have to align on what impact is. Like I say before, is it behavior shift? Is it other adoption measures? Is it opinion? It's quite difficult.
And I think, I've got a bit of background in CME, and I'm going to say something slightly rude here, but, you can end up dwelling so much on the outcomes measurement and turning it into such a complicated project that the project doesn't happen in the first place, when you just sort of think, well, that's a shame, because there was just a nice little bit of education we could have done. Everyone would have been happy and off we go. But actually, we've gone a little bit too far. The pendulum has swung a bit too far. Anyway, these things are easy, to debate. It's never quite right. It's about getting balance. Michelle was talking about data protection as well, causing problems. I mean, there are practical problems to collecting data and measuring data and so on. We're going to jump around a little bit. We haven't got a huge amount of time, so I'm going to jump around. But I would say to the audience, please keep these comments coming in, and we'll sort of feed them in as we can. I wanted to jump to the conferencing event side of it. It's just an obvious sort of discussion point. Things are different now than pre-pandemic. But where are we going? What's your opinion? We swung from a lot was face-to-face. Let's be honest about it. There's a lot of talk pre-pandemic about going virtually, but a lot of people, we weren't doing that much. Then we suddenly went, and everybody who'd said, oh, that's a bit tricky, suddenly found that you could do a certain amount anyway. And then we went through that whole hybrid thing. And I hate that term, but people talking about hybrid, and I get the sense, I'm pretty sure I'm right, that there's a strong shift back to face-to-face I'm talking about the medical meetings specifically. I'm talking about those meetings, you know, engaging with the HCPs at the medical meetings. What's your view? Who wants to kick off with that? You know, Gary, go on, lead off with that one. What are you seeing from the agency point of view? And to some extent, you'll do and go with the clients and so on. But what's your view on the direction of travel?
I think I'd echo what you're saying. You know, there's you know, we've obviously been post-pandemic now, you know, there's that kind of virtual only into the hybrid space. And that, you know, I've seen numbers of metrics about, you know, talking about metrics. And it seems that there's still a preference for face-to-face. I think HCPs want different formats, different options to attend meetings to give them flexibility. But ultimately, there seems to be some push from the societies themselves to drive face-to-face kind of traffic to meetings, which is an interesting observation, I guess. I think we see that as well. You know, we you know, these platforms that industry, the societies use are often quite inflexible. They often don't generate huge amounts of traffic. They're very expensive to sponsor. So I think there's been a little bit of, you might say, skepticism from pharma in using some of these tools, and would probably rather spend some of their investment in a face-to-face setting, albeit with some hybrid options as well. So I think we are seeing definitely a move back to more face-to-face activity. We know that's a central pillar of why people go to conferences, to network, and to have that human interaction, actually. You know, I think that's what people have missed through the pandemic and really want to get to that. You know, we're seeing more people going back to offices. You know, it's never going to be back to what it was, but by the same token, I think people want that human interaction again. So I think we see that in a reflection, really, it's more face-to-face, hybrids there, but I don't think virtual only is an option anymore. I don't think people particularly like that option. I don't think pharma particularly does either. So I'd echo, I think generally I'd agree with your statement, but yeah, that's what we're seeing as well.
Okay. It's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, we're sitting here doing a virtual meeting. And I, you know, it's a very simple virtual meeting, but I couldn't have got you three in a room together, probably, very easily. I couldn't have got, you know, 150 odd people from all over the world together in a room. And for an hour or so, we're going to have quite a useful session. So, you know, I think people are quite quick to dismiss virtual when actually it's incredibly useful. I find the face-to-face is clearly much better because you've got so much more to gain out of being face-to-face, but it comes with so many now problems, you know, in terms of, you know, time, commitment, funding, sustainability issues, all of that. And medical societies wanting them to be face-to-face, let's be reasonably honest here and say that's probably partly driven by the fact that it's the economics, the business model for face-to-face is straightforward, whereas it's not so straightforward for virtual or hybrid. But the hybrid thing, which I think, if I'm understanding you correctly, Gary, you're sort of hedging yourself slightly, sitting on the, and going, well, hybrid, there's a hybrid element in all of this. But what does that mean? And at the end of the day, do you just give a bad experience to those online and those face-to-face because you're trying to sort of do a bit of everything? I think there's a bit of a problem in there. But, you know, Jane, go on, I'm going to drag you into this one. What do you see from where you're sitting?
So hybrid, I think, is here to stay for a number of reasons. Not least of which it widens the audience. It has applicability in, you know, rare diseases, and as I mentioned before, where you're having a much smaller audience. It allows people to access content from all over the world. So I think hybrid is here to stay, but I think this part of the industry has transformed the most during the pandemic, because that user experience, as you mentioned, wasn't great at the start, but now there's all sorts of tools, techniques, etc., that companies are employing to make that just as good for those who remote access the meeting as to those who are face-to-face as well. And it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. We're also seeing a push back to face-to-face for the bigger congresses. But I'm intrigued to see how that's going to go, because most of our big clients now also have a massive push towards sustainability.
Exactly.
And the intersection between, you know, travel, attendance at congresses and being sustainable is going to be an interesting debate over the next few years.
I mean, you can't get away from the fact that the most unsustainable thing you can do is get on a plane and fly. Yeah. It's simple as that. And yet, you know, there's nobody seems to quite sort that one out. Well, go on, Annette, what do you think? And I mean, I was on a so-called hybrid meeting not so long ago where there weren't many of us online, but we were completely ignored. I mean, there's no two ways about it. We were completely ignored. And so I get the idea that if it works, it can work brilliantly. But I think in practice, an awful lot isn't working at all. Therefore, we get a bad experience. Therefore, it becomes a bit self-defining. It's not going to work very well. But Annette, on that point, how are you seeing the conferencing side?
When you talk about remote versus kind of in-person meetings, I think it depends on what kind of meeting you're talking about. And if you're talking about a Congress, I do think, I agree with everything that everyone said so far, really. There's definitely a move back to face-to-face. And I think there's an intangible value that, you know, people gain it out of going to those events. Having said that, I think it's great that typically the kind of presentations are much, often streamed live. You can access them very quickly after the Congress, whereas, previously, maybe not everything would have been on their website. Maybe you would have had to wait a week or whatever. So I think there is a nice kind of balance, I suppose, from that perspective. And, I wonder if that kind of improves the kind of equity of access across the world, because maybe you can afford to pay £500 for a Congress registration, but you can't afford another couple of grand to get on a flight, go to a hotel and that kind of thing. So I think there's a nice aspect there. And I think for if you want to go to a data presentation and you want to hear the latest data, it's no different hearing it online to sitting in a 3,000 person Congress hall, seeing the speaker as a dot on the stage. Like, there's not really any difference to the actual presentation. You don't get that kind of browsing kind of effect where you listen to things that perhaps you haven't thought about. You would go and listen to the specific data that you want to hear, and that's kind of it, which makes your world quite limited, I think, as a doctor, which I think is a little bit dangerous. But I think if you extend out meetings beyond congresses and you talk things like advisory board meetings and things like that, and again, there's a sort of networking opportunities there if you do them face to face. But it's that certainly, although we were doing them pre-pandemic, but I think they've really gone up in quantity and frequency. And I think, whilst we do some face to face app boards, I would say probably most of them thus far have been remote, which allows you to, gather people more easily. They're shorter, more focused, and I think they work quite well from my experience.
Okay, it's interesting. We've got a lot of comments coming into the chat, which I won't try and individually pull out, but I hope people in the audience anyway are having a look at those. But there's a number of comments coming in, which is getting at the sort of inclusivity, extending the access to conference type activity. I said this a couple of times in recent webinars and things, and it does worry me a little bit. So what's your view on this? So, and it ties in with patient voice and so on, okay? So, a couple of years ago, as we were all going virtual, there was a huge amount of enthusiasm for finally just recognizing that we could bring patients into a room and they didn't have to travel and they didn't have to negotiate the stairs or whatever it was. I mean, some very practical problems in there, which was always a problem with conferences that attempted to bring patients into the room. And then it was virtual. So that was brilliant because everybody, but also, just anybody. He doesn't, anybody anywhere, whether it's financial or physical or whatever the limitations are, can access and get involved in events, right? And that was all absolutely wonderful. And then it seems to me this whole move back to face-to-face, if anything, is pushing those people out again. It worries me a little bit. So have you got a quick answer to that, anybody? But importantly as well, let's just spend a couple of minutes talking about the patient voice, because that's very different from now from a few years ago. And I know we always used to talk about the patients and so on. But patients are much, much more involved now in lots of different sorts of ways. So specifically, has anyone got a view on whether I'm right that we're pushing them away again from events, but also just a general point of, the patient voice in medcoms now? So there's two questions in there. Sorry, I shouldn't do that. But anyway, who's going to go with that? It looks like you're disagreeing with me anyway, Jane. Go on.
I don't think I've witnessed the patient voice lessening in Congress activities as a move back to face-to-face. I think patients are now involved in a lot more aspects of development and communication because the pharma companies have really embraced that in the last few years. But there are, hybrid again allows people to access and for the meetings to be more inclusive. But there's also ways for, you know, patients to be videoed and for that to be played at a conference, et cetera. There's a lot of ways that patients can still have a voice in meetings, even if they're face to face. But I think the most exciting development is the increased involvement of patients in clinical trial development and all the communications around that as well.
Okay, go on, Annette, pick that one. Let's go for the broader topic of patients involved in the sort of work we do. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, particularly in our clinical trials experience team, they do a lot of work, understanding the patient voice. Obviously, there's the Patients as Partners conference, which I think is on right now,
this week.
I know we're attending. So, I'm sure we'll get a lot of insights from that. But yeah, I think it's so important. And I do think that there's a growing recognition of that. You know, it seems to come up in several different ways. I mean, at least one of our clients has incorporated their kind of patient team into like medical affairs, whereas, you know, it was previously kind of quite separate, which, you know, I think is a good thing, because we so often talk about the patients and what medical affairs is, you know, that's the ultimate, end user, I suppose, or the people that need to get value from what we're doing. So, hopefully we're not going backwards. I hope not.
Okay, Gary, have you got a view? And specifically, a couple of just basic questions, Gary. A company like Fishwack, have you got patients or patient representatives involved in projects as advisory groups or in any sort of, you know, tangible sense like that? I know some agencies are, but does that happen at Fishwack?
Yeah, we do, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, we, you know, in our strategy team, we have somebody who focuses on patients and partnership, you know, with societies, PAGs, you know, other organisations. We absolutely recognise it's critically important to have the patient voice brought through, because we're seeing, like I was saying right at the start, about health changing. You know, we're seeing a switch to shared decision making in the future, more of a conjoined journey. It's not about the HCP journey or the patient journey. It's about the journey they both have together, because the information bounces off each other through the digital platforms they're both able to access, you know, and patients are much more informed than before. And so their voice is really, really loud and really critical. You know, we see obviously this map reflecting with GPP4, you know, positions on patient engagement. So it's definitely here to stay. It will increase. The role of social media is getting more and more important for pharma to embrace. So I think, but it does introduce a complexity to the strategic planning, you know, around how to develop your narrative, how to, you know, deliver that all to HCPs, but also patients as well. How do you do that? How do you vary the message? It does get a lot more sophisticated. So, but absolutely, we involve patients in lots of different activities, really, because it adds to the insight, really, ultimately, that you're trying to get to really understand, whether it's clinical developments or whether it's, as I say, narrative developments or onward engagement. I think, you know, HCPs themselves like to hear about the patient voice as well. So, yeah, it's something that's critical, as I say, here to stay as well.
But it is important. I mean, we talk about including the patient voice, but you need to have patients at the table to hear their voice properly, I suppose, is something that I would just go. It's very easy to talk about, you know, or have a meeting about patients and what patients think. And it turns out there's a bunch of HCPs talking about what they think patients think. And I just think, you know, we've come a long way, but the practicalities are there. Practical challenges are there. So we need to do more than just talk about listening to patients. We need to get them involved in the room.
I agree. I think there's an opportunity to do more, you know, what you might call 360 outboards, where you've got a mixed audience of HCPs, you know, different types of HCPs, of course, expert community, patients, patient groups, payers. You know, I think we should see more of that kind of insight generation from bringing those groups together. That doesn't happen quite enough. It's more than it used to be, but I think that's where there's a big gap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try and move on. Sorry, I'm going to move this on, okay, because we're going to run out of time. And we've got a couple of crucial things that I want to talk about before we actually sort of wrap this up. We could talk all afternoon. I get that, okay. Well, certainly I could anyway. I wanted just to bring it back in-house, you know, as a business, as it were. It's a different sort of business now than it was a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. Again, I know we were going down the line of flexible working and all the rest of it, okay. But just can each of you just very quickly talk about, you know, what's happening in your businesses now? Is everybody coming back to the office? Are they all being told to stay away? Is it hybrid? How's it working? Just very quick, we're going to have to be a bit quick on this one, but just give us a sense of how people are actually doing the job in a business like yours now. And I'd like, I don't know how much difference there'll be between the three companies, but let's see whether there are some differences. Annette, if you're there, come on, just say a little bit on that point.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different to what it was pre-pandemic. I think pre-pandemic, pretty much everybody was office-based 5 days a week, and that's not the case anymore. So we definitely have kind of a hybrid working approach. It's allowed us to, I think, it was difficult, I think, for people perhaps to hire remote people because that's not the kind of way we worked. Whereas, you know, the pandemic kind of when everyone's working remotely allowed us to probably expand our kind of horizons in that way. So we've got people who are on remote contracts and they're integrated very well into the team. So I think that's a difference, and that's helped us to, you know, to boost our hiring, I think. But I think, yeah, most people are in sort of 2 or 3 days a week. There's a really good vibe in the office. You know, there's particular days. Thursday's always a really popular day. And, you know, there's a really nice kind of social kind of atmosphere. And, you know, there's always after work drinks on Thursday, which is good.
So you're sort of leaving it to people to make up their own mind a little bit as to whether they come
much. It's more of an encouragement because I think we recognize the value of kind of bringing things together. People together in person for those kind of personal relationships, but it's not being, you know, we're not beating people with a stick about it. We're not mandating particular days or anything like that. Okay. Just saying, like, try and come in a couple of days a week, and most people are very happy to do that. Some people invite, you know, 4 or 5 days a week if they live close and, you know, they like the office environment, but I'd say most people are two or three days a week.
Okay, Gary, is that similar at Fishwack?
Pretty much a couple of days a week we're seeing. I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, obviously we have great flexibility. We allow, you know, people to work remotely, but by the same token, it's good for people to interact in the office. I think for more, you know, for more junior members of staff, I think those interactions are actually critical in career development. You know, yeah. I think we've all had that benefit ourselves of working in office environments and picking up lots of different, you know, insight and learnings from colleagues that you wouldn't necessarily always work with, you know, and I think that's what you miss when you work virtually. So we certainly encourage people to come in, but it is difficult because often, you know, like we are here, as you mentioned before, Peter, virtual meetings. What you don't want to do is go in the office and then you're in a meeting room all day on virtual meetings. So yeah. It's quite a balance. So, you know, again, you know, like Annette says, we encourage people. For us, it's Fridays. You know, we have some great activities that really bring people in. We have a lot of different food themed days, of course, and other activities, and that always seems to get a lot of people in. But I think we're seeing more and more people coming in. I think it's fair to say maybe, you know, between it was like 1 day a week. Now it's a couple of days a week, maybe creeping up to 3 for some and more for others. So I think it's slowly but surely, you know, contracting back to not quite where it was pre-pandemic. But I think there'll probably be a balance at some point, maybe, yeah, around 2 to 3 days for everybody.
Okay, Jane, what's your view? I mean, it always intrigues me with these conversations because we tend to make grand statements about it, but actually it's a very individual thing, isn't it? The thing that struck me over the last couple of years is we've sort of all turned to individuals and said, whatever is good for you, we'll support. But you end up with this conflict between managing the organization and actually individuals, some of whom want to come in, some of whom don't want to come in, some of whom want to work at, I don't know, odd hours of the day, some of whom, et cetera. And it's nice to say, you know, do what you need to do the job, which is what anyone would basically say. But actually, we're in a business where everyone's got to work with each other. So you've got to find times when you can actually collaborate, even if it's only online. But even that's getting difficult, isn't it? Because everyone's working different, or it seems to be starting to get difficult because everyone's working different sorts of ways. Again, I'm saying too much. Jane, you tell me what it's like in Aniculum.
Well, prior to the pandemic, we had already started a flexible working approach. And I guess our business model may be slightly different from the other two agencies represented here, although I don't know. So please disagree if I'm wrong. Because our teams work collaboratively across the world. They don't just work with individuals in their own office. So even before the pandemic, we were used to being on Teams calls with team members all over the world. Coordinating a particular project or a particular account. So now we're back to hybrid approach. We've given people the opportunity to choose. So many people work fully from home, go into the office if there's a meeting or a need to collaborate on a project. Many people are starting to go back. We're seeing more and more people go back. But we've also worked really hard to try and integrate new team members who joined remotely. And to Gary's point, you know, get that peer-to-peer learning in the first few months, because that's so important. So it's a lot of hard work, I think, but it's worth it to retain the culture and the team cohesion across the world.
Yeah. Always makes me laugh. I mean, so much we talk about here, but it always makes me laugh the idea that the juniors, inexperienced people, are coming to the office to gain experience, but all the people who've got the experience are sitting at home. I know it's not as simple as that. I've deliberately left this topic to the end, and we've run out of time. So I'm deliberately doing it so that we don't end up spending a lot of time on this. Okay, but we are going to have to talk about it. It's coming up in the comments. It's the big elephant sitting there if we're not careful. And we're trying to talk about where Medcoms is going. So come on then, very quickly, but I'm afraid it's going to have to be a little quicker in the next few minutes. Where are we at with AI, specifically with generative text type, the ChatGPT type of AI? Where are we at in Medcoms? Who wants to kick off and give us some sort of an idea of where you're at? Well, who's going to volunteer? Go on.
It's Gary, such go a complex on. Topic, isn't it?
Exactly.
There's different opinions about whether it's going to lead to a lot of, automation and threat to jobs. And there's other opinions about whether it's going to enhance what we do. And I'm more on the latter side, that I think it will augment what we do rather than, replace the need for writing and that kind of thing. I think it's how you use the tools, it's still in its infancy. There's still a lot of policy generation to be done within agencies and pharma about how to use these tools. What's the guidance? Everyone's looking at what the guidance is. We're going to see a lot more on that in the next 18 months or so, I'm sure. The tool itself is really useful. It can help improve quality. It can help, generate ideas. It can check what's been written. There are really practical, really good ways to use it, but it does need to be used within balance. And, it's something which it's a very complex area to navigate through for businesses at the moment, and I'm sure all businesses are forming, groups to do that.
Okay. Go on, Jane, have you got, at Amiculum, is there a policy in place now to guide your staff in terms of how they can or can't use something like ChatGPT? Are you at that stage yet?
We had a meeting just this week, actually. So we released a few weeks back guidance to our teams of what not to do, obviously, relating to client confidentiality, data security, etc. But I think, like everybody else, we've encouraged our teams to play and explore the different software that is available. And I think our clients are doing exactly the same as well. Nobody quite knows how this is going to be used yet, but there's a lot of potential. So we've got a number of different projects that are ongoing at the moment that look really quite exciting. Where they'll take us, I can't tell at the moment.
Okay, go on then. Annette, come on. Where do you sit on this one?
I think I agree with everybody else. I mean, I think you've done a number of webinars on this topic, Peter, and I think I agree with your philosophy and, that it is a tool. It's not going to replace a medical writer, for example, but it is a valuable tool to use. I think it's fair to say there are different perspectives. You get quite a wide variety of opinions. Personally, I'm more worried for society at large than I am for Medcoms specifically. That's a whole other subject.
Another webinar, okay.
But very encouraging people just to understand it. Again, with all the safeguards in place, the confidentiality, don't put any client data in there, this kind of thing. We have to make sure that we're all tight on that. But we've got a lot of things coming from the group, the wider publicist group. One of the benefits of working in a big network, I think, we've got our own GPT type tool that we can use, that we're just kind of exploring, so people don't have to make their own accounts. And we're just encouraging people to sort of really explore, play, understand it, so that we can hopefully we'll be well placed in the future to, if we get the opportunity to sort of integrate it and use it a bit more widely, then people will understand it. So, yeah, I think it's exciting.
Okay. I'm laughing because for anyone watching this, if they're wondering why I'm starting to laugh, when we had our little chat last week about we spent most of the entire time talking about AI. So I've deliberately left that to the end. I know there's a lot more we could talk about. I know we're not really answering anyone's questions there. Several people have said at various points in the chat that, oh, there's a topic you could spend a whole webinar on, Peter, which is a nice little opportunity for me to say, look, there's hundreds of videos over at Network Pharma TV, and we have explored many of the topics that we just covered in very quick fashion, specifically AI, but also some of this other stuff with working practice and conference over at Network Pharma TV. Okay, what I wanted to do is just get a sense from you three of the sort of state of the business and some of the ideas that float. And I hope anyone listening to this, I'm quite sure they've got some food for thought. And there might be some people out there arguing and disagreeing with us, but that's part of the fun of it. And I suppose the message as I wrap up, and we do need to wrap up, is Medcoms has boomed over the last few years, hasn't it? Yeah. And I'm fond of saying Medcoms is booming. Just to finish this up, are we still in a healthy place? Everyone still happy to nod away and say it's still, is it maybe slightly a bit calmer than it has been the last couple of years, which have been a little bit crazy, but still very busy? Are we all just going to agree with that? It's still a healthy, thriving business. And just listening to you talking, there's lots of opportunity for people to come in and have exciting careers. So that's sort of the message I want to get to at the end. All right. Okay. Right. Look, we're way over time. It's fun. Please come back and we'll talk more. Please enjoy your days. I know I can speak for all of you and say that anyone watching this can reach out via LinkedIn. That's the easy way of doing it. So please do, guys, all reach out to each other. If anyone wants to know what I'm up to, medcomsnetworking.com. And just because it is Medcoms Day, I'm just going to make that point. Go out and watch or follow hashtag Medcoms anytime and you'll find interesting things to follow. But today in particular, there is a lot of interesting stuff going on. So it's great to see the global community showing itself a little bit. So everybody, I'm going to stop the recording there. People in the audience, don't all run away. We've got a couple of minutes. But can I just say, in these strange and uncertain times, everyone take care of themselves. Take care. Bye.